Hi, and welcome to the Webster University Geneva podcast. I'm Juliana Sandholm-Bark. I'm assistant professor at Webster University Geneva. I do research on historical and contemporary discourses on art and its value, the impact of digitization on the art market, and the emergent art scene in Switzerland. In addition to teaching courses in art history and current art, I just launched Meet the Artist, a public lecture series this spring. With us today, we have our fifth speaker in the Meet the Artist lecture series, Marquise McGee. Marquise is a composer, a sound designer, a musician, and artist currently based in Geneva, Switzerland. He earned his bachelor's degree in music performance from the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, with concentrations in saxophone and musicology, and has worked professionally as a performer and composer in venues and festivals such as the Wheelock Theater in Boston, Massachusetts, the Big Ears Music Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Exposure Science Film Hackathon in Lausanne, Switzerland, the Casino Theatre in Geneva, Switzerland, amongst others. Welcome, Marquise. It's good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also on the show today, we have Tim Young, who's here to ask the more technical questions about music. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
So, Marquise, let's start with something a little bit general, a baby question, because I don't know all that much about sound art and what a sound artist does. So maybe you could start by explaining, you know, how is sound art different from music, and how is what a sound artist does different from what a musician does?
So sound art is an artistic discipline in which sound is used as a primary medium. It's a fairly new way of discussing sound and non-traditional forms of composition and a new kind of genre of music. Mm-hmm. I would say that it's different from music in that it's used to explain more non-traditional means of experiencing sound or manipulating sound or interacting with sound.
Okay. And how does a sound artist, how is that different from a musician? Because you consider yourself a whole bunch of things, right? Including a musician.
Right.
So how do you
So I
make sense of all these things that you do, and how do you differentiate, or is it not important so much to differentiate between the different labels that I used to introduce you?
Right. So I don't think it's too important to differentiate. I think that when I call myself a musician, there's a certain context there, that there's a history of traditional forms of music that are expected of me to perform. Or partake in. When I say sound art, it can be a more general sense of kind of using those non-traditional methods of performing sound and music.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about sound art, do you feel that it has a difficult entry point? Because one of the reactions I got when I was sitting there with Francesco Resi Visconti, our head of photography, when at your Meet the Artist presentation, and you know, his reaction to some of the pieces were, it's kind of noise. Mm. You know, and I think this is something that I've seen applied to a lot of sound art. Mm-hmm. That people find the entry level, the entry really difficult to get into it. And you know, what's your impression of that?
Right. Well, I think many of the audiences who enjoy sound art or are in the spaces that sound art is premiered tend to come from a more musical background or musical training. So sound artists are usually composers by trade themselves, and through that they're usually premiering their works to composers. So there's a certain kind of arena in which everyone knows each other, or at least they have an established set of rules or traditions that they can interpret the noise with. I'd say that the difference between noise and music, or noise and sound art, all lies in familiarity and intent. So with familiarity, we recognize a song. Cross-culturally, you can tell what a song is and what a song isn't. But when we become more experimental, when we become more free with harmony and rhythm and melody, that line becomes a bit more blurred. So for a composer who has been working with more free rhythms, harmony, and melody, that noise may sound more familiar to them. It might be actually incredibly recognizable. And then for intent, I think that we should look at what the artist's intent in terms of using certain sounds, being able to differentiate between what a simple sequence of sounds is and what their intent with the sound was. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, and but with that in mind, it's still that question about the entrance, because I mean, we've been to Art Basel with the students this year, for example, and I saw a little bit of sound art there, but not very much. You know, it tends to be things more with another element, another medium attached to the sound art. And I don't know, have you ever seen any examples of sound art where it really is purely the sound and not other things attached to it?
Yes. One of the types of sound art that I've seen is experiential sound art. And a lot of experiential sound art is kind of, you are sitting in a room and you're experiencing all of these different sounds that the sound artist has designed and is catering to their audience. There was one piece in particular, Veils and Vespers by John Luther Adams, and in which you just kind of sit in the pews of church, and there are long drones of noise kind of being expelled through different speakers surrounding you. And there's not a lot of explanation given to someone when they first walk in. It's a very long piece. It's supposed to run for at least 48 hours. So I saw a lot of confused faces. The point of entry, I'd say, for that piece was very high, the level of entry. But essentially what that piece was a long composition. John Luther Adams, he had a formula for coming up with the tones that you hear. Whether that's important to you as an audience interpreting the art is, for lack of a better word, subjective. Because I think a lot of art and a lot of sound art, it is subjective. What means the world to one person can mean absolutely nothing to another.
And I think where we're seeing these boundaries between music and sound art, it's fascinating for me. Like, do you know Max Richter? Max Richter,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So you know about his sleep piece. And would you consider that to be, is that sound art or is that music?
I would consider it one and the same. Really, it's a non-traditional piece of music. So in that it can be sound art.
It's probably worth us explaining. I mean, shall I explain or do you?
You go ahead.
I mean, technically, it's a piece of music which lasts for 8 hours.
Yes.
Which he will play, and people are invited to come. Usually at the end of the evening, it starts at, you know, 10 or 11 at night, and he plays it, and people are supposed to sleep while he plays. And I know that he's released a shorter version of this, like a From Sleep album, which is, you know, 40 minutes, or a traditional record, you know, a traditional piece of music out of this other piece of music. But I'd love to know what it's like to go and sleep. You know, the idea of going to a performance and the idea is you don't listen to it, it seems, or you do listen to it subliminally. I don't
right
know.
I think maybe the my interpretation of it is that you're listening to it subliminally. The fact that you have this prompt to sleep can mean a few different things. how difficult is it to fall asleep while this person is performing music? Is there something about the music that leads you to become more drowsy? Is it a boring piece of work so it's easier for you to fall asleep too? I think there's a lot of different interplay there that you can work with.
Yeah, and is it meant to be appreciated also in a group, in a collective, where you're expected to sleep in a space that is not your home with other people
right.
in the room? And right.
I mean, technically, a concert that you go to could be interpreted as a piece of sound art, technically, you know. Mm. But I think your point about intent is very interesting.
Thank you.
Because that's it, really, you know. What's the intent of the musician when he plays his concert?
Mm.
It's entertainment, or is it sound art? You know, where's that boundary line? I think that's the interesting thing about sound art at the moment. You know, where do we put the boundaries between music and, well, or an entertainment and a piece of art? Where does that lie, you know?
Mm.
Right.
But is it not true that music, being a more traditional term, you know, music, the history of music, you know, goes back to, I think you even mentioned the first instrument of music is 40,000 years old, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that's the tradition, that's the history of music that we have. We can refer back in time, but sound art is relatively new. So there's a sense that you can play around much more with what you do. There's less, right, constraints.
Exactly.
So that's why one would become a sound artist.
Exactly. To be able to use sound in these non-traditional methods, to experience it in different ways, that there's not really a genre of music that is, I guess, as general as the term sound art. So within sound art, you don't only see non-traditional compositions, not non-traditional music, but you also see within it new methods of experiencing music and sound. So mm-hmm. The music itself within a physical installation of sound art could be in a very traditional form. It could be recognizable music, but the method that you are interacting with that music may be totally new or non-traditional.
And is it correct to say that the origins of sound art were the 60s, or does it go back earlier?
I like to think that the origins of sound art are traced back to the first instruments, which were bone flutes. About 40,000 years ago, bone flutes were created out of vulture bones, and they were hollow, and they were intentionally created. You can see from the work done on them, and you could say that's the origin of sound art. That's the origin of music. I would say that now that music has so much history with it, that this kind of subsection of music, sound art, In the way that it's used now, it is relatively new.
But then there is a mainstream to sound art too, since it's got a tradition of its own, right? According to what you just said. So how would you differentiate between the mainstream of sound art and sort of alternative, more experimental forms of sound art today? Such a thing?
I would say that there is such a thing, but because the way that it's used now is so new, it's almost as if everything is fair game. As long as sound is used as the primary medium to convey the emotion, convey the concepts, then it's very, very much fair game, because you could even make the argument that a traditional form of music is used in this different way. Is that sound art or is that not? So there's a lot of discourse going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be very, very curious. There are now many new degree programs for sound art, for example, in Zurich and in London and in Canada. And so with this very new subsection of what music and art and the intersections between those are, I wonder how they explain it, how they where the line is for them between what sound art is and where music is.
Mm-hmm. So you explained to us the other day that you collaborate with visual artists.
Yes.
And you collaborated with a whole bunch of people, but one of them was Preston Faribault. And so I was wondering, how does this collaboration with somebody else work for you? And I guess I have another question as well, which has to do with your creative process. It's like, how do you... This is typical me, right? I throw out two questions at once, which is totally not the way I'm supposed to do things. But let me just ask them, and then you can sort of answer whichever you want first. How do you begin if you are commissioned, or if you want to compose a piece of sound art? Where do you start? What is your inspiration? How do you go about that process, that creative process? And then how do you collaborate with somebody else and bring them into your process is my question. I guess this is like a two-part.
Okay. So in terms of my creative process and my inspiration, inspiration for me comes from many different places. Even if I'm just walking around, if I hear a really interesting sound, I like to investigate it. I always have a recorder in my bag. And I'm like, oh, was that a bird call, or is that something falling behind the tree? What was that? Mm-hmm. So I like to investigate. I like to hear new sounds. In terms of sound art, I like to think of new ways to use sound by watching other, other people live their daily lives and work in their daily lives. So with Preston, working with a blacksmith, I had seen him work before. I'd seen him creating sculpture work on his anvil, and just hearing the pattern that would come out of him working with different forms. Mm-hmm. I thought, there's a lot of sound there, but not only that, in terms of music, there was sound and there was pattern. So there was a form that I could work with, and that we could try and figure out how to make music with it. How to make a non-traditional form of creating music, and how we could interplay that with visual art and sound.
So it starts from something external. You hear a sound and you want to go further with it.
Right. And I also just have notebooks of different sounds that I've heard, and I couldn't find this weird springy sound, like coming up with different adjectives for it and wanting to try and recreate it in either a physical piece of work that uses sound in a different way, or in a composition.
We have musical language, we have, you know, visual language, we have also verbal language. And so, you know, it's interesting to see how these forms of communication are interconnected, or how artists use different languages, right, to create. So I was talking to my dancing students, they're dancing half the time, so it's kind of true, but my dance students, and I was asking them, you know, how is what you do connected with the verbal, and how is what you do connected with the visual? I ask them all the time, you know, because their medium is dance, is movement, is the physical body. And so for them, I was interested to hear them say that to hear visual art described helps them make the connection to how they then would do things with physically.
Right.
So for me, that's really interesting. It's sort of the verbal is sort of the medium that facilitates that communication that's going on between the visual arts and the physical, you know, movement.
Right.
So I'd never thought of that before. So I'm asking you, you know, to maybe think about how the verbal arts, you know, help you as a musician, as a sound artist.
Right. No, I think verbal language is incredibly important, especially when talking about sound art, because it is a sonic element that we use to communicate with each other. I also like to think of the musical language that we use to communicate with each other. For example, in my performance background, I had training in jazz. So being able to communicate musically with another musician is something that's trained from day one. You have to be able to work with other musicians, and many times you're not looking at each other. So say the pianist knows of ways to kind of give you cues to go from point A to point B, and the drummer works with the pianist and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. It's a very... It's a non-verbal way of communication, but it's still utilizing sound. So I think not only listening to new sounds is inspiring, but also thinking about the ways that we, as people, interact with sound on a daily basis through talking or hearing, say, a loud noise outside of this room right now. We don't know if that's danger or if something has just fallen. And we should check it out, just the ways that we experience sound on a daily basis. Mm-hmm.
So just going on from that, how important do you think the title of a piece of sound art is?
That's a bit of a hard question because we just talked about intent. And I think that in many ways, an artist's, and the way that they title a piece can give us all the intent that we need. So in that way, I think it's incredibly important. But sometimes, I know from, I'll speak for myself. If I'm composing a new piece of work, and I could have all of the inspiration in the world, but I may never find a title for it. So I just want to leave it as Untitled One. It sounds very uninspired, but... It's very hard.
Yeah. Do you think the title can actually spoil the piece of sound art? Because I mean, you know, I've noticed this is something you could put on a painting, you could put on any medium. But I find in particular with sound and with music, often the title will change my perception of what I'm experiencing really fast, much faster than it will with a... Because, I mean, often with a painting, the title is a straight description or something that's very, you know, it says what it is pretty... It's easy to give it, but I don't think with a long piece of music it's always easy to give it a title that just... That isn't too clichéd or too obvious... But also adds something, you know, adds a level of understanding or complication that makes it more interesting, you know. So the fact that you have trouble choosing titles, that's interesting, I think.
Mm. Yeah, but I do think that titles can spoil a piece of sound art. But I like the word that you use in terms of complication. It can complicate it sometimes, because if you are experiencing a piece of sound art. That's named piece, and you have an expectation of very subtle sounds, very calming, and you put the headphones on, and all of a sudden you hear this just incredible cacophony of noise and hammers hitting blocks of concrete, then it's added another level of what your perception was going to be of those sounds. It can also work to the benefit of the sound art to set you up for an expectation and completely change that expectation.
So departing a little bit from that conversation, I want to talk about something I'm very proud to say that I learned a word from you the other day, one of many, I should say, but Klankenboss.
Yes.
I love that. I love the ring of it. I love the ring. I just wanted to say it on this podcast. So could you tell us about this a little bit more and why it's important and how it's connected to what you're doing now, which is your involvement with hackathons? I didn't quite understand, to be honest, what Klankenboss was and how, you know, what the tradition of this musical event was, and maybe you could connect it to hackathon or maybe not at all. I'm not sure.
Sure. So Klankenboss is one of the very first museums dedicated to sound art. So it's actually located in a forest in Belgium, And throughout the forest are all of these amazing pieces of sound art. They are essentially new ways for audiences to interact with sound and experience sound. Mm. So anything between a speaker inside of a tree to... I showed a video during the podcast in which people were kind of jumping on top of hydraulic systems to trigger different pressures of wind to come through an instrument. That's what Clank and Boss is all about, just experiencing and interacting with these installations, which could be considered newer musical instruments, but since they don't follow the tradition or traditional genres that are set up right now, we would classify them as sound art, and they cause you to think about how we interact with sound in various ways.
And could you connect them to hackathons, or is that a whole different thing?
I could connect it to hackathons. A hackathon is essentially a coming together of different people with various skill sets, in which new content is created or a problem is solved. So, for example, I'm a composer for the Exposure Science Film Hackathon, and essentially what they do is they bring together scientists and artists and musicians and filmmakers together. And they are tasked with explaining a scientific concept over the course of a weekend in the form of a video. All the teams meet on Friday. No one really knows each other, but mm-hmm. they're tasked with creating that. And what comes out of it is this amazing interdisciplinary work from each team mm-hmm. In which they utilized... their different skill sets to create something completely new. Mm. So in that, I could kind of relate it to sound art, because sound art isn't just made up of composers or musicians, anyone with backgrounds in sound per se, but people who are very just interested in conveying a different concept by using sound. It's not creating sound for the creative, for the sake of creating sound, but to convey a certain emotion or to convey a certain concept.
Mm-hmm. So the Clank and Boss would be a purposeless kind of exhibition of sound where people might get something out of it to solve problems, but sort of on the personal level, whereas hackathons are more collective, where you solve a problem together. And there's that result at the end, there's that product that you produce at the end, which yes. is then... appreciated by audience right there and then, or where does it, what happens with that video that you create together?
It all depends. In the Exposure Science Film Hackathon, what happens is that there is a personal viewing for all the teams, and then they have a separate event at a theater for the entire public to come and vote on the films, and maybe vote is an improper word to use, but asking the audience, what did you think of this? Did mm-hmm. you think that it illuminated the topic or concept in a good way?
And what happens with it? Sorry, I'm just trying to understand. So the product then, you know, gets disseminated. And then what happens with that team? Do they ever come back together, or do they just drift off in separate directions and never work together again? Or what is the outcome for you, for example? Specifically, what was the outcome of this last one for you, the one you did?
For me, I actually still am working with many people I met through the last hackathon. Many of the people that you meet through hackathons may have skill sets that you are looking for in a new project that you are working on. So I still keep in contact with a lot of the filmmakers and science communicators that I've met through that event, and we are now collaborating on different projects.
Oh, that's great.
Thanks.
I want to be at one just to listen to her, just to witness this. It must be fabulous.
Oh, yes, the sort of exchanges. So
anybody can just go and listen and look at what's going on and then look at the outcome.
Exactly.
That's awesome. So when's the next one?
The next one, the Lausanne dates were just announced for December 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, I believe.
Okay.
But the information can be found on exposurefilmhackathon.com.
Okay, that's great. We should go as a class. I'll bring my students, my first year seminar students.
Yeah. So I'm interested in how the linear nature of sound art is restrictive. So, you know, how you are always, and I noticed in your work, you're trying to break out of that to a certain extent by using the things of experience where you use a spoon, and that's, you know, that's bringing in a piece of sound that's related to something else. So that restriction of, because I mean, a painting or a photograph or all these other things, they kind of, there's a single moment, you can experience the whole thing in, technically, in one go. You stand back, you look at the thing.
Mm.
But with a piece of sound art, you have this, you have an amount of time that is almost always, to experience it properly, you need it. And as you said with one of the things earlier, you know, sometimes that's 48 hours. So it's almost impossible to experience the whole thing in one go unless you're crazy and you want to stay up all night.
Right.
So that kind of restriction, is that a, does that, is it, I mean, does it free you up, or does it add an element of restriction that makes it more creative because it's there?
No, I think it makes an artist more creative, because you're actively thinking about your audience and their perception of how long they're going to be there, or how long they're going to be experiencing the sounds that you've prepared for them. Because most songs are about 2 minutes to 7 minutes long, so you'll have to work in that time frame. But I would say that when sound art has a physical component, then those time constraints are more easily lifted. For example, with the Zdarsi organ I talked about in my presentation, people could experience it at their own leisure. But as long as you were in the vicinity of the organ, you could hear it. So in a sense, you were experiencing it at all times as long as you were in the vicinity, and you didn't have to actively partake. You didn't have to actively listen at every moment that the sound was being created.
We were just talking earlier about the anxiety of influence a little bit, and how, you know, we're all sort of in awe of people who'd come before us and like, oh, how am I going to create music that's just as good as theirs, right? This sort of idea. I don't know if this is something that's troublesome to you, this idea of, oh, how am I going to top this? Or is that something you...
No, It does make me a bit anxious. But it actually really makes me hopeful, and not in the sense of, oh, when can I create that next thing, that like the next big thing. But I just hope to be a part of all of the amazing work that I already see happening, which that's exactly what it is. It's amazing that there's a new tradition kind of being started in sound art. And I just kind of hope to be along for the ride.
That's a very millennial attitude. I'm in awe, you know, really, of millennials in the stereotypical sense, you know, that they're not so bogged down by the past. In fact, I keep getting surprised by students who say, well, maybe it's because they have no sense of history, a lot of them, you know? and this is a separate problem. But the point is, they're really not afraid of going out there and doing something new. Whereas me, I tend to always overthink everything, right? And so I become inert sometimes when I let that whole consciousness of the past get to me to such a degree that I'm like, oh, you know. And
It is a big question, you know, because you're embracing the childishness in things. The idea that you don't have any influences and that you produce just something that's raw art, you know, or you have to. But having all the influences on that, I think produces a better. But there's kind of a sweet spot, you know, where I think you can look at a lot of artists' careers, and you'll see that, you know, everyone will recognise that this album or this work of art or this thing is their recognised pinnacle. But I think it's for me, it's more important to look at it from a personal point of view, listen to their catalogue, and you might find that the thing that people consider to be the pinnacle of their work is actually not necessarily the thing that you believe to be the best work of art they've ever made.
Right.
I mean, if you take the biggest example, like the Beatles, right? Everyone would probably say that the most famous album, the best album they made, is Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right? But for me, it's not their best work by any means, you know. John Lennon actually said about that album once that it's a one-song album, which is that the last song that's on it, A Day in the Life, is it. He considers the album to be that song, and the rest of it was for him was basically junk, you know. But you do, that's a good question. I should ask more people this question, actually, which is the best Beatles album? Because I think you could learn a lot, you know.
About them as people.
Yeah, exactly. Shall I ask?
Yeah. Start today.
He's like, I don't really listen to the Beatles.
I hate the Beatles.
Do you really?
No, I'm just.
Is Yellow Submarine an album?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. There you go.
That's the ones my kids like the most. Yeah. And actually, it's kind of cool because it's got one side that's orchestral, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a cool one to choose.
So could I ask, who are the biggest influences in your life, like musical influences?
Oh, the biggest musical influences, I would have to say first my two saxophone mentors, Jerry Coker, who is one of the great figures in jazz education, really great guy and great author, Greg Tardy, and I mentioned those two in terms of my musical influences in sound art because they both really inspired me to learn how to improvise not only in music but in life, and that's really helped me in all of my projects since meeting them. And then in terms of composition, Yoko Kanno, who's an amazing composer involved in anime. I don't know if you're very familiar with it, but
you mentioned her in the lecture, right?
Yep.
What are the titles of famous stuff she's done?
Should
have asked. What are the titles that you of some of her work?
She's worked on Cowboy Bebop, Ghost in the Shell, Zankyo No Terror. Many films and shows. She's practically a chameleon. She can write for so many different types of music.
Ghost in the Shell is the one that I'd heard, I think. Yeah,
it's really good. You should.
So I have a big question. The most transformative moment in your musical career, what has it been? Has there been a moment that's been sort of, big for you in terms of your production?
Right. I'm not sure if I mentioned this in the lecture. I think I did, but when I was growing up in Boston, I was involved in music, I was involved in theater, but I didn't really have a big appreciation for it. I wanted to do robotics engineering, but I'd say that the most transformative moment for me in music was when I was teaching myself how to play the saxophone. It was just something about learning that. I guess getting cues from if I was learning the saxophone right or not through the squeaks or it actually sounding like music just kind of completely changed how I thought about sound and how we interact with it every day. So I would say that was the most transformative moment for me.
I'm going to be a little cheeky. I know you have your saxophone with you.
Yeah.
She smiles. I was hoping you could play something.
Sure.
And it's my brother's birthday, and I was wondering if you could play Happy Birthday for my brother Conrad.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure, definitely.
But like in a jazz way, right?
Like in a jazz cool way, yeah. Like in a sound art way. Like how would you reinterpret that Or, you know, like, sure. I don't know if that's possible. Just,
is this our way of wrapping up the podcast?
Unless you had another question.
So you can say something while he's getting it out of the case. You can, you know. Would you like me to do that?
You want to finish it? Somebody looks like he wants to do it.
we'll leave all this chat in. It's always entertaining for everybody. So, thank you very much for coming to talk to us today. It's been really interesting. I've learned a lot, actually. And if you want to hear any more of these podcasts, all of our podcasts live on podcast.webster.ch. There's quite a collection now of Meet the Artists, that some longer than others, but all very interesting and very diverse in the kind of art that we're seeing talked about. And I think we're going to hear something now. Sorry.